Okay, time to go. So, continuing from where we left off, we had gone through the low-level mechanisms, and now we're moving into the mid-level deception mechanisms. And generally, the middle level, and we'll show you the picture again here in a minute, we're talking about the ability to train or study the target and test their responses, which is you get repeated exercise of response methods. You wait until responses are predictable, right? So you go through this training process, and for example, you know that every Tuesday at 10 a.m. there's a fire alarm practice or some such thing. And then you create false or known rejection or acceptance. So a false reject could be exploited by a real incident. So if they're doing fire alarms at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, you start a fire at 10 a.m. on Tuesday and nobody's going to pay much attention to the fire alarm. Or known acceptance to induce desired behavior, so you know that they respond to something in a particular way and you just accept that you cause them to do that. And then you can exploit the conditioned response. So you use their training against them or use the training to identify them or authenticate them. You want to close that door and hit the next slide. So in the big picture of cognition, we're talking here about this mid-level of cognition. It's from the observable set and the set of observables, but not so much the sensor bias, so the sensory data, and some level of the control of actions, up through training and instinct, which includes the ability to measure effect and do evaluations, but not necessarily what you would normally think of as the logical decision process, and skills and methods, but not necessarily, or maybe all of tools, skills, and methods, but not to the point where you're using them optimally. Next slide. All right, so one of the phenomena we find is called the sensory habituation. And in sensory habituation, sensors end up starting to ignore repeated inputs. Okay, so for example, we talked yesterday about the sensor level at which you start to ignore the projector sounds in a room or repeated sounds. Sensory habituation happens not only at the physical level, but also at the pattern recognition level. That's what we're talking about here. The sensor's response requirement can be overwhelmed. And so what happens here is when you get more things than you can handle at that given sensory level, then you start to use pattern matching to make decisions. You don't think about what's going on. So if something becomes very standard or something is happening at such a high rate that you can't handle it by thinking about each one, you go towards pattern matching responses. And this is, I mean, there are parts of your brain that do this. You can think about driving, right? Many of you, driving is not inborn, right? It's something that you learn. But if you've driven for a while, then you may notice that you don't sort of remember where you went for the last 25 blocks, but you're still going and you haven't crashed into anything. You know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. So that's a pattern matching sort of situation. And not only does this happen when you're ignoring things, but it happens when you get too much stuff. So if you're hit with all sorts of things you have to do, you're just going to respond with your pattern matching. You're not going to be able to think through each item you do and in a standard way. And this is, of course, the basis of a lot of training. And so then focus of attention is also forced by training. I mentioned that airline pilots have a trained sequence of observations that they make with regard to their instruments. They regularly scan their instruments. They'll scan the outside the window and so forth. And in fact, it's well known that the time of most crashes of planes happen between the sort of I just learned how to fly level and where you're thinking about everything you're doing at a high level of cognition, and the, you know, your IFR, you've gotten your IFR instrument flight rating. So that what happens then is you get to a level where you sort of think you know how to do stuff, so you're not thinking about it with your logical reasoning all the time, but your pattern matching skills aren't quite that good, and you don't have your scan pattern set up right. And so what happens then is you tend to get disoriented And so this more training can force more focus of attention. And this is why, you know, they talk about you train as you fight. I'm sorry, you fight as you train. Sorry. You're supposed to train as you're going to fight so that you can fight as you train. The notion here is that in a battle, you know, you've trained when you see an object over there that looks like an enemy tank, you turn towards it, and unless the light over here comes on that says it's a friendly, you shoot. And this happens very quickly. Okay, in the battle of, I guess it was 73 Easting or 60, I think it's 73 Easting. It's a very famous battle from the Gulf War where I believe it was three U.S. tanks killed. It was over 30 Iraqi tanks. The whole thing happened in less than a minute. They popped up over a ridge, said, oh, whatever they said, and they didn't think about it. They just turned at each target and went boom, 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 boom. Three tanks as fast as they can do it, load for the next shot, aim and fire. Boom, 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 boom. And that's by training. They're trained in how to focus their attention. What's the biggest threat? What's the target I can hit right now? Hit it, get the next one. Boom, 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 boom. So then there's a sequencing of sensors is predisposed. There's in most situations, there's a tendency to sequence signals by known sequences. So I can produce sentences that are slightly out of order, for example, and you'll read them correcting my order automatically. And in fact, it's one of the problems in copy editing, especially your own works. It's just about impossible to read something that you wrote and pick out the errors. You don't see what you wrote. You see what you thought you wrote. And you can read it 50 times, and somebody else comes along and says, you know, why do you have two these there? Two these where? And they point to it and say, I don't see two these there. And then they say, no, look, the. Oh, my God, I didn't see it. So this is one of the things that the recent editors have been very good at, right? When they do their spell checks, they find double words. Sometimes you actually have a double word that's useful, but they tend to find these things. The sequencing of where you look and when you look is something that tends to be predisposed at the pattern matching level. So you're not thinking about where I'm going to look next. Your eyes go through a pattern. Advertisers take advantage of this. Okay, when you look at advertisements, the advertisers understand that when you look at a picture, you have a scan pattern. I don't remember it exactly. I think you start in the upper left-hand corner. Oh, no, you start at the focus of attention. If there's something bright or something moving, you focus on that. Then you go up left, up right, then you go down right, and then back up to the left, and then down left. Don't ask me why. That's just I believe that there are cultural differences. So if you're from an Arab or a Hebrew writing country, then you read right to left. And so things... You tend to use your patterns differently, and I'm not sure, but it's likely, I guess, that Chinese read up to down, and they have probably a slightly different pattern for looking at things on paper. And there's a prioritization scheme is predisposed. There's a, for example, and this is as far as I can tell, this is hardware. You know, it's evolutionary in nature. You have a tendency to prioritize vision over sound. So if something is important. You know, if you're sitting in front of displays watching what's going on and you have sound and video input, even though the sound input is very, very important, it says pull up, pull up, pull up. If I can get something on your video display which is sufficiently startling and sufficiently important for your focus that you're paying attention to that, you will ignore pull up, pull up, pull up. And after you ignore it for the first couple of rounds, then you'll habituate to it as a repeated input. And you'll just sort of turn it off in your mind, and you'll never notice it. And there are airline crashes that have been, you know, caused by the pilot and co-pilot focusing on some indicator light that wasn't on. This happened in Florida with a Delta flight. They ended up crashing into the Everglades because they were focused on this light bulb that wasn't lit, that was supposed to be lit. And all the other indicators didn't matter because this seemed to them to be the most important thing, and time got compressed, right? It seemed to them like they'd only been looking at it for a few seconds, but it had been, you know, 20 or 30 seconds, and they crashed. And then the other thing is slow change. This is the boiling frog, so I don't think I've told you the boiling frog story here yet. So the boiling frog story is that if I take a frog and put them Take a frog, and I have a pot of boiling water, and I toss the frog into the pot of boiling water. It will jump out of the boiling water pot right away. If I take the frog and put it in cool water, slowly increase the temperature, lukewarm, warm, luke hot, I don't know what it's called in between hot and warm, sort of hot, real hot, boiling, the frog will boil to death and will never jump out of there. Okay? And that's because the frog can notice the big change in temperature, but not that slow change of temperature. And it's the same with people. You put a person in a steam bath, and you keep turning up the temperature slowly, they'll slowly go unconscious and die. Okay, that's why there are warnings, for example, on hot tubs. If you have a hot tub at too high a temperature, when they get in, they'll jump out. But if you turn up the temperature slowly when somebody's in a hot tub, they'll stay there, they'll fall unconscious, and they can die. They can drown in their hot tub from the same sort of phenomenon. And this happens all the time in, for example, looking at network logs. There were experiments done by DARPA, by DISA, Defense Information Systems Agency, early 1990s in the European arena, where they have anomalous network traffic. And the anomalous network traffic shows up at some rate, and they were paying attention to it, and they get some number of false positives, some number of false negatives, and they chase after it. So what they did was they intentionally turned up the rate at which anomalous activity was happening. It's like turning up the alarm rate on your alarm system. So what happened was the people watching it got more and more signals coming in, and they habituated. They started to ignore more and more of it. And it got to the point where there was something like 10 times as much alarm traffic as there was a month and a half before, and they just didn't even notice the difference. And you can slip all sorts of things in under the alarm levels, and they just wouldn't notice it. So this is an example of this sort of habituation. Next slide. So you prepare predisposition. Patterns tend towards predisposed matches. So a good example of this is if you have a notion of cause and effect, you see ICMP packets of some sort on your intrusion detection display, or in another venue, you see things turning up in the hills that are windmills. Or you assume that those are windmills if you've seen windmills up in the hill before, and you assume that those packets are that same ICMP packet you saw before if you see them again. You get predisposed. So you create a theory, a pattern that you're looking for, and it's not a perfect pattern. It's sort of a pattern that easily discriminates between what you didn't see before and what you do see now. You figure it out that that's what it is. And from then on, when you see that pattern, you're going to match it, and you're predisposed to see that theory as what's going on. And it's difficult to see any other notion of what's going on than the theory that you formed, the pattern that you're matching. Experiential predisposition in the face of ambiguity is another thing that's been observed. It's a tendency towards previously experienced patterns. We're getting into the area of the way you see. And so I just want to sort of bring it out now, and I'll be talking about it more again later. The way you see, you when you look in this room, you have a picture of walls and a ceiling and a table or whatever. And you have this model of the world as this three-dimensional thing. What hits your eye is not a three-dimensional thing. It is light. Your eye is essentially two-dimensional surface. Right? So you're interpreting two-dimensional signals, and the notion that your two eyes somehow give you this three-dimensional thing is baloney, because if you close one, you still see a room, you still see people and chairs and so forth. Okay? Yeah, it helps you a little bit with some aspects of three-dimensionality, but with one eye closed, you still tell that there are people and chairs that they're sitting on that are behind them, and a ceiling that's above them and so forth. This is all made up in your mind. Okay? It's not that there is no reality. It's that everything that you perceive out in the world is just a bunch of stuff that hit your eye, a bunch of light that hit your eye. And your brain interprets that. And the way your brain interprets it depends on what you're predisposed to see. And it's the same with your hearing and your touch sensitivity. So your hearing, for example, you can hear the same word as somebody else hears, and you both hear different words. The same sound came into your ears, but you hear different words. Okay, and I have this problem all the time, right? When I give talks, I say something and somebody comes up and says, "Well, you said this," and I said, "No, that's not what I said." You know, and I repeat the precise words that I use, or I give a precise wording of what I'm trying to say, and they don't understand. In fact, you can just repeat it to them 3 or 4 times; they still don't understand. Okay, and it's because your hearing and your sight and all of your sensory capabilities depend on what you anticipate is going to happen. It depends on your expectation. Your expectation drives what your ears are listening for, what patterns they're matching. And so when you see those patterns, you're going to match them, even though they may not be the actual sounds or signals being emitted. Okay? So this is this experiential predisposition, and it's worse in the face of ambiguity. Okay, so, for example, when you look at clouds, you see pictures. You see a horse or whatever you're looking for in the clouds. The cloud does not, believe me, have a horse. Okay, there is no horse sculpted into the cloud. You look at the cloud, the horse comes from you making up a horse. You have this set of patterns. There's random stuff out there. You're going to see one of them. And one of the more interesting ones here is we have audio tapes that have been prepared by somebody. We're not going to be playing them here, but a professor at a university who studied this, and you get sounds like, you know, in coming in two ears, like basalita crossing out of it, basalita crossing out of it, and they repeat them again and again and again, and before long you start to hear all sorts of words in there. Right? You may hear a tune, you may hear a phrase, and it'll change as you listen. It'll change with time what you hear. Same sound. Okay, so this is ambiguity. At your sensory inputs, you use your pattern matching to create the patterns of what you see, of what you observe, of what you pull out of that random noise. And this has all sorts of problems. So if I introduce ambiguity, then you're going to see what you want to see. Then there's the organization information by previous bias. So there's a tendency for you to organize everything new as something old. So if you were educated in engineering as opposed to, you know, say, I was brought up in electrical engineering. And many students in information protection were brought up in computer science. And they take different views of the world. They have different perspectives. They're trained in different ways. So I have a bias, okay? I have a tendency to organize things in terms of the engineering principles that I've learned in early engineering school. And computer scientists have a tendency to organize things in terms of the organizational structures associated with computer programs. Okay? And those biases cause you to see things differently than other people. People with similar training tend to see things in a very similar way, and there's all sorts of problems with that, like groupthink. But we'll get to that later. Then there's another issue, and that is there's a memory association limit that force you to structure things. This is a fairly old result that's fairly widely recognized as having, you know, may not be perfect in all cases. But basically, the way you remember things is by putting them into chunks, and the number of chunks that you can remember and associate with each other are 7 ±2. So the sort of the poorest human being at chunking information can do it at 5 chunks. And the best human being at remembering information can do it at 9 chunks. There may be an occasional outlier, somebody with brain damage that's lower on the scale or something like that. So this chunking phenomena means, for example, that when I make a PowerPoint slide, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this has 5 bullets. I better not have any more bullets than that on a slide if I expect people, normal people, to understand it. Right, and that's one of the reasons we try to teach you how many things to put on a slide. Okay, because if you've taken courses in presentations, for example, they'll tell you, you know, you should have 3 to 5 things on a slide. No more than, don't make your slides busy. Don't put 40 bullets on a slide. Okay, and that's why, because people have problems cognitively putting it into their mindset. Now, this is sort of an interesting experience. When I was had recently graduated from college, I got a job at, I'm trying to remember the name of the school, gosh. So it's an all-women's college in Pittsburgh, Chatham College, that's it. And I was the network administrator for their dinky little computer at this all-women's college, which, you know, for me was, of course, a dream job. You know, how could you ask for anything more? And so one of the young ladies that was studying there was studying psychology and asked me to come in for an experiment. Because, you know, they're trying to do experiments, you get a pretty biased sample set if all you have is, you know, women from the women's college. It's not a very broad spectrum of people to you know, they're all educated at the college level. It's a liberal arts college, so they all tend to be in liberal arts, and they're all women, you know, ages 18 to 20-something, typically. And so she asked me in to do this experiment, and this was an experiment. And so I happened to be there also, and so I was the first person to do her experimental run, and she had just learned about this 7 plus or minus 2 memory chunking phenomena. And about feedback, you know, pain and pleasure type feedback. So she brought me into this room, and they had a set of electrical circuits hooked up. And I believe there were 8 rows of 8 things, 8 knobs you could touch. So 64 things, and each one it was set to electrocute either on the left or the right. So you'll get a mild shock on the left and a knot on the right, or a shock on the right and knot on the left. So this is 64 bits of information. And what you're supposed to do is run through from beginning to end, feeling what each one is, and then go through without getting shocked. So I went through, remembered what each one was, and then went through without getting shocked. And she said, "That's impossible." She said, "It's just not possible that you can remember 64 things. You can't do it. Nobody can remember 64 things." But I did it. First time out. So she asked. She had to ask, right? She said, you know, she was flabbergasted. It's supposed to take you 15 or 20 times, you know, before your other learning mechanisms kick in. You can't possibly, in your short-term memory, chunk this and remember it all. So I explained it to her. I say, you know, I've been operating computers for a long time. In fact, I was a computer operator in my earlier days at Carnegie Mellon University, where we had a TOPS 10 computer system. And user IDs under TOPS 10 computer system are octal digits. They are sets of 2 6 octal digits. Like 146246 243231, which is my user ID from 1970 something or another. Okay? And as an operator, people call you up and say, "I'm having a problem," or "Could you mount this tape?" Sure, who are you? "I'm 732416 412305. No problem. And you put that in your mind, and you walk around, and you do all this stuff, and you remember that number for the next several minutes, and then you forget it. So, to me, this was, you know, 137214961, or not, no nines, but whatever it was. It was just it was like 4 user IDs. No problem. 4 user IDs. I've handled that before. No sweat. So the reason I could do that is because I chunked it. Okay, I chunked it. Actually, there are 3 levels of hierarchy, right? First of all, I went from the 1 0s, from those bits, into octal digits. And people that use hex, of course, can probably do better than me. But I'm an octal kind of guy, because that's where I came from. So this hex stuff is too hard. I remembered sets of 3 bits as if they were 1 chunk. And then I remembered sets of 6, pairs of sets of 6 as a user ID. Okay, so that's 2 sets of 6, which is each a set of 18. So that gives me 32 bits. Okay, so it's 2 user IDs is all I remembered, I guess, to get through 64 bits. So that's chunking. That's how your memory works. And if you learn how to chunk, you know, they got these memory gurus that are out there, and they can remember anything. You give them a list of 400 names, they remember them all. They use association. Okay, like I associated it to user IDs, although those are sort of like random numbers, but they associate it to other things, and they do chunking. And if you learn to do that well, you can remember a lot of things. But nevertheless, these limits force you to use structures, and the structures you place on these things limit your ability to process them. So if I put these things into into octal digits in the form of user IDs, and somebody said, add up these numbers, I could probably do that very well. But if they said, pick out all the ones, that'd be a bloody pain, because I'm not remembering them that way. I'm thinking of them in a different way. So, by the way, when you write computer programs, of course, the way you store information dictates the computational efficiency associated with the computations you do on it. So one of the big tricks that you learn from experience in computer programming is learning about data structures and how to store information in such a manner that when you use it later on, the uses you have will be efficient. And chances are, if you store it efficiently for a particular use, it'll be inefficient for some other use. So you optimize across the set of uses, and you take time-space trade-offs. You may even store it in redundant forms so that subsequent computation is optimized. But that's all because of this structuring, and I'm getting off subject when I get too heavily into how you write programs. So I'll move on. Finally, we have contextual associations. It's given a plausible theory, people tend to believe it. Okay? And the classic is the because, the magic because. Okay? What happens here is people use the term because to associate a theory with something. So if I create a plausible theory and you don't have anything that says it's not true, not only will you believe it now, you'll start to put that into your mindset and believe it forever. So if I explain to you that 2 and 2 is actually 5 because the mathematics you've been using is different from the normal mathematics of people that come from where I come from, you'll believe that I must come from somewhere different and have some different mathematics, and that will be the explanation. Done. Because I use the magic because word. Okay. Not only that, the way I just told you that, I don't know if you missed it, the way I just told you that used a because in it. So because I used a because in my explanation, you believed it. Not necessarily because it's true. It turns out it is true. But that's not related to the fact that I gave you a plausible theory and you tend to believe it. Next slide. So for deception, you want to find a plausible theory, a plausible explanation, they call plausible deniability, right? You give them some plausible excuse, and if not examined too closely, you'll get away with it. All right, there are also pattern matching limits. One of them is called like as like. There's this tendency to associate similar things together, and so the classic association is disease. You know, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, I guess it is, you get yellow dots or something. Anybody ever have Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever? Like you get yellow dots, whatever it is. The assumption before science got into all this genetic thing was that the disease, the symptoms, these spotted things, were associated somehow with the cause. So they were looking for something spotted that could be the cause of that spotted fever. Okay? If you got ill and turned yellow, that's what happens when your liver fails, you turn yellow. The presumption was it had to do with something that you ate that was yellow. And you say that's ridiculous, haha. Baloney. It's not ridiculous. It was true for, you know, since the beginning of time until very recently, the last, you know, so many years, and there are probably still lots of people in the world that believe that eating yellow things make you turn yellow. Right? Or maybe it's the plant that has the yellow thing on it that makes you turn yellow. Whatever it is, like as like. An example of this is mode matching. This is Satir's mode, and I have a slide that will go into some more detail on this later, but I'll just walk through this. If it sounds good to you, there's the question. Sound good to you? And the answer is that resonates with my ideas. Okay? Then that matches, right? Sounds resonate. Resonate is something people typically associate with sound. So that'll be a friendly conversation. Similarly, he'll torpedo me. If you tell it to somebody who's in the Navy, they'll like that. They'll say, "Ah, I feel the same way you feel." I don't know how else to explain it. That's a tendency to associate similar things together. There's a tendency for dissonance when like is not as like. So, for example, you can mode mismatch. See what I mean? I hear you. This stuff doesn't kind of work the same. And if you're in a conversation and you do this, if somebody says, "See what I mean?" and you say, "I hear you," what they interpret is that you're really saying, I don't actually agree with you, right? I listened to you, but I don't actually agree with you. Okay, see what I mean? I can see that. No problem. You agree. Okay, and they'll like you. You know, that believe it or not, just by doing that, they will tend to like you and feel as if they're communicating more effectively with you because you've matched sensory modes. Similarly, so you say, see what I mean? And you say, here, the other one is, he'll torpedo me. And you say that to some Air Force pilot who's like, so? You send all the torpedoes you want. I'm in a plane. What's the big deal? I guess, you know, in Star Trek they have torpedoes that would hit a plane. But, you know, those are missiles to us. All right. Photon torpedoes would be different to them. So and then there's the other one is the oversimplification tendency. And if you've probably heard of Occam's razor, this is this thing that the scientific principle that says that the simplest theory that fits is always preferred. So like if I have a theory that there's this thing called gravity that causes this thing to accelerate and fall towards the ground, and you have another theory that's like there's these 36 types of subatomic strings, spring-like things that connect everything together, and that's what really makes this fall to the ground, then anybody with any sort of scientific bent will immediately apply Occam's razor and say, look, this does just fine for gravity. Gravity is a better explanation because it's simpler. Okay. It turns out, of course, that the reason that that string theory came along is because at some low level, gravity breaks down or it doesn't quite work or it's somehow related to something else, and that's why super string theory or whatever it is now something that the physicists have been thinking about.
But isn't the point of that just keep your model simple because if they serve your purpose, you want to use the simplest model you can. Newton's laws are the same way.
Well, you know, I guess what Einstein said something along the lines of, I don't remember what he said. Gosh, my brain isn't. You know, the simplest. We want the simplest solution that works, you know, whatever it is. But it has to always work is the problem. So Newton's laws are great, except that they don't work near the speed of light. So no, Newtonian physics falls apart near the speed of light, or when you get to subatomic particles, or even to microminiaturized devices. All right. So because other forces are more important. So what happens is that in science we take the simplest theory that fits. And the question of what fits is a question of what you're trying to do. But the point is that there's a tendency to take the simplest thing. And in fact, to take a simpler thing than you actually need to do the explanation. So we tend to oversimplify. For example, people are much more comfortable with black and white decisions than shades of gray. So you're offering somebody a decision, you say, well, you can go with the low-priced alternative, the medium-priced, or the ultra-super-fantastic one, whichever one you like. Okay, that's, you know, that's it. You don't tell them, well, we have 473 options. You know, we can give you a variance in price anywhere from $200 to $47,000 and in increments of $300 except between $4,000. Yeah, no, low, medium, high. I can do that. I'm a medium kind of guy. Then you say, oh, would you like it? Would you like the super option? And they say, well, how much more is it? Oh, it's just a little bit more. You know, you're already paying $8,000. This is only another $400. Oh, yeah, it's cheap, $8,400. No problem. Okay, great. Would you like the mag wheels? Oh, how much they cost? Oh, it's cheap, $250. Well, that's kind of a lot of money. Yeah, yeah, but look, you're already at $8,500. It's only $8,750. It's no problem. Oh, yeah, sure, I'll go for it. What the hell? You know, I like the mag wheels. And this is how that game is played, right? Simple decisions, black and white. You don't present shades of gray. Easy decisions. Next slide. People prefer that. Here's the third slide on pattern matching. This is misperception of random events. And there are a variety of things that we do that causes misperception of random events. One of them is called the clustering illusion. And the clustering illusion is sort of interesting. What happens is that we were talking about pictures in the clouds before. You create clusters from randomness. Okay? If I go up to a board here and fill it with randomly located dots, just I use a random number generator to figure out a really good high quality random number generator, or one that's so good that, you can't tell the difference, and fill that thing, say, to 20% full with dots, when you look at it, you will pick out areas of that thing and say, there's a cluster here. There's a bunch of stuff over here. There's a correlation. You know, something in here is causing this diagram to lean down to the bottom left, or maybe it's the bottom right. All right, so you will create pictures out of randomness because your pattern matching mechanisms are designed to do that. That's what makes you good and efficient, by the way. Okay? The reason you're able to very quickly look at somebody and tell who they are, facial recognition, is because of that real quick matching of patterns. It doesn't matter if my hair is a little bit different, or, if my glasses are on cockeyed, or if I'm standing a little bit, you'll still see me because you're very good at that pattern matching. However, if I'm trying to fool you, that means I don't have to get all that close in order to fool you. Right? I can, you know, I can do the Mission Impossible thing, you know, and take a facial mask, and if I'm across the room and my voice sounds sort of similar but a little bit raspy and I say I have a cold, it's credible. Unless you get up close and personal. There's the law of small numbers. You've all heard of the law of large numbers, right? That's what statistics is all about. This is the law of small numbers. The law of small numbers is that a small number of examples will be over-applied. Okay, so, you know, I saw it once, might just be chance. I saw it twice, oh, well, it's practically a sure thing. By three times, I'm dead certain of it. Happened three times in a row. It's got to be, right? No, it doesn't have to be. It's people tend to over-apply small numbers of samples. Another one is misrepresentation of random dispersions. So this one's shooting streaks is the typical one. Who here believes that in basketball, players get hot streaks and cold streaks? They get shooting streaks. Anybody believe that? Sure you do. Of course you do. I believed it until I looked at the numbers. And there are periods of time when somebody's shooting, you know, a very high percentage for 8 or 9 or 10 shots. And they think that's a streak. They believe that's a shooting streak. But it turns out if you just take random, you know, you say on the average they get 80%, you know, from the line, okay? And you generate something that's 80% ones and 20% zeros with a fairly good random number generator, you will find that there are runs of 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 ones in a row and just as many zeros in a row. So you'll think that, I'm hot today, I'm making them all. But it's really that you're so good, you're about 80% good, you know, and you're in one of those streaks where you happen to be getting a lot in. You probably won't get as many long streaks of bad shots if you're 80% from the free throw line. But if you're like me, you get exactly the number of long, you know, hit streaks as long miss streaks, which tells you about what my average is. It's a 50-50 shot, right? All right. So so shooting streaks fame in baseball. Then there's the creation and adoption of causal theories. We adopt theories to explain and we retain and face the refutation. Okay, so a good example of that, probably a bad example, and I'm about to get in trouble. A good example of that is this theory that God created the universe. Okay, so gee, what created the universe? You're sitting here 5,000 years back, saying what created the universe, and you say, it was a mystical creature, we'll call it God. So now you got a theory. Okay? Now there haven't, of course, been any refutations to God, because you can never refute the presence of God, because we always say, whatever it is that you're saying, well, that's just God's will. You know, God made you think that. You know, it's like, what was his name, the comedian that used to say, the devil made me do it? There's a comedian that was very, very well known some time ago that used to say, the devil made me do it. That was the excuse for everything. But if you forget for a moment about religion, which some religions have, you know, lots and lots of things that they claim, the earth will be destroyed on January 1st, 2000. It's the millennium. I'm still here. Oops. Well, God saw that we were believed in him all of a sudden, and therefore the earth didn't get destroyed. Whatever the excuse is, there's always some excuse that comes. And there are all sorts of theories that we adopt. You might adopt a theory about this ICMP packet is causing some disturbance in my network, or this UDP packet is the cause of this thing. And in the face of it happening without that UDP packet, the typical answer is, I must have missed it. You know, I'm sure it was there because I already believe that the UDP packet's the thing that caused this. So if I didn't see the UDP packet and then I saw it, then it must be that I missed the UDP packet. Or there's another mechanism as well. Oh, zowie. Right, so once we have this theory, it's going to take a lot of refutation before we throw it out. And then there's regression fallacies. This is a classic. After a big week, you seem to be in a slump when you return to normal. Okay, so you get, what's his name, Sammy Sosa, you know, who was in a slump. Right, he was in a slump, I guess, at the beginning of the season because he wasn't quite on the record-setting pace of home runs. Right, last year he held the world's record for about 2 days. Right, before somebody, what's the name of the guy that actually won it?
Mark McGwire.
There you go. So I mean, they were neck and neck for a long time in home runs. Okay, and everybody was paying attention to Mark McGwire, but I thought Sammy Sosa was awesome. But you know, Sammy Sosa had more home runs than Mark McGwire for a period of time, but was at that time the all-time leading home run hitter. So now they come into the next season after setting the new world record pace and smashing the old world record, and they're not quite at the world record pace. And so we say, well, that Sammy Sosa's in a slump. You know, hasn't hit a home run for 3 innings. My God, you know, he's no good anymore. He's on the way. No, I mean, sometimes you're good and sometimes you're not. After you've done something really outstanding, everybody says you're in a slump because you've only done your normal, extraordinarily wonderful work. Next slide. Focus of attention limits. So we have something called attention span, and I noticed that many of your attention spans seem to be waning right now because I'm going into a lot of detail on all these slides, but we'll continue. Because, you know, I'm timing it, right? I'm timing it so that you won't run too much out of attention before I take a break, and my throat won't get too sore before I take a break. People tend to have limited attention spans, whatever those are, and attention moves from sensor to sensor. And you can use an individual sensor's move to observe or attend. So your eyes move from place to place. If you try to keep your eye fixed on something, you can't do it. All right, try really hard to keep your eye fixed on this pen right here. And you'll see, no matter how hard you try, your eye will move away. You can try, it will move away. You can try it on a piece of paper, in whatever conditions you want. You try and look at one letter on that page, and you'll see it. Your eyes will drift, and you'll come back, and they'll come back, and it just happens, because that's the way they work. Okay, your sensors move around to observe and pay attention to certain things that they want to pay attention to. So there are specific time limits associated with these things, and so you can exploit the attention span. You present a really boring picture, and every once in a while there's a little blip in it. That's the thing that's actually important. But if they've been looking at this, you've seen the TV shows where you got the guard who's, you know, watching the empty parking lot. You know, well, I've been watching this empty parking lot for the last 18 weeks. You know, I'm a full-time 2 a.m. to 10 a.m. parking lot watcher. And let me tell you, at 3 a.m., there's not a whole lot of action in that parking lot. So if there's a little flicker on the screen, might lift his eyes up and notice, but after the little flicker on the screen, if there's still nothing in the parking lot, there's nothing in the parking lot, there's no question. So the trick from all the TV shows is that we put up a picture of the parking lot in front of the TV camera, or we record the TV camera taking the picture of the parking lot, and then we put in the recording when we want to go use the parking lot. So we cut the wire to the TV set and insert the wire to the recording device. Actually, you clip the playback machine onto both wires, typically, or whatever the cabling system is, and then you push the play button, at which point it's playing the same thing that they're already seeing, and you snip the wire to the camera, and then you can walk around in front of the camera, and they'll never know the difference. You might even reattach them afterwards if you care to. So, you know, there's not a whole lot to pay attention to. Tendency to listen to novelty is another one. If you've heard this before, see, one of the problems that you're having, one of the difficulties you're probably having listening to me is that as I go from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing, I have no really exciting pictures on the screen. And I apologize. I'll find some more exciting pictures on the screen. But in the meanwhile, just the fact that they all look the same means you really don't want to read this. Okay? And if I say the same thing again and again, you only listen to the really interesting thing. And that's why I need to have better and better bizarre examples for you, or you'll get bored, right? Because at this point, if I just come up with one of those typical cut-the-wire type examples, you're going to say, yeah, so what? New inputs are more attended to. You just pay more attention to them because they're new. Now, Shannon's information theory is related to this. Shannon's information theory, the syntactic information theory that's the basis for a lot of our optimization of the use of information technology, is basically that information is more important, has more content if it's less common, if it's more unusual. So if you hear some really strange noise, you know, in your office, you're all going to look. What is it? Where is it? Okay, now these days, you know, we have beepers and telephones and all these things that have these weird noises. In fact, one of the classics, you get so accustomed to your cell phone ring that on radio commercials, they'll rig that cell phone ring in the commercial, and everybody in their car is like looking for their cell phone to pick it up, and it turns out it's the commercial. But the other side is if I come up with something that, you know, quacks like a duck, you're going to be looking for a duck. So that gets your attention. But after you've heard that duck sound about 473 times, you say, shut off the bloody duck. You know, it bothers me, it disturbs me. And then, well, maybe that's after 10 or 12 times. After 400 or 500 times, you probably just pay attention to the duck as much as you paid attention to the clicking on the keyboard. You just get used to it. And then, of course, when ducks show up, you don't even notice. Larger differences drive more attention. Right? A little bit of extra light will wake you up. By the way, that's another interesting thing I should note, and that is that when you have lower light levels, you tend to have chemical processes in your brain that move you towards a more sleeping sort of state. So having now just flipped the lights on for a moment, I'll let you wake up, and then I'll turn them back off, and then you'll just collapse into sleep. Larger differences drive more attention, so if I scream really loud or produce a really bizarre sound, it'll get more attention than a slightly different sound. Novel features attract attention, weird shapes and so forth, and slow changes tend not to be noticed. So you probably don't notice the slow temperature change in this room that's been taking place since we've been sitting here, but it is in fact getting warmer because we're all in here. There's a tendency not to follow through. And that is, we have a tendency to obsess, to compulse, and to doze off. These are three different tendencies. You know, in different situations they happen. You'll obsess on something that seemed interesting to you before, but you don't actually have any really reason to watch it, but something else is happening. This is the guy, the pilot and co-pilot, looking at this button or this light that wasn't working in the jet while the thing said, you know, pull up, and they ran into the ground. Some of us are compulsive programmers, you know, or, you know, I'm a compulsive audit trail reviewer. I have to review my audit trails every day or many times a day. And if I've seen, one of my compulsions is saving my documents. This is where the train compulsion from using computers. The editor I use, I tend to use an Emacs-like editor, and Control-S saves the document. And so you will see it. I literally start to choke if I haven't pushed Control-S for like a minute, and I'm in an editor. And it's particularly bad. There are times when I'm actively doing something and I'm editing the control file and I don't want to save it until this other thing is done. And I have to really fight, like to breathe. I have to fight to breathe because I want to save it, but it's not time to save it until that thing finishes. And I'm like, I gotta save it. I can't breathe. It's terrible. It's a compulsion. A compulsion to save my Emacs documents. It's a good compulsion, right? It's one that I've learned from years of experience is very beneficial. You know, people that don't save their documents quite often have a tendency to lose more of them. But sweet surround. And then, of course, there's a tendency to doze off. Anybody that attends my classes knows a lot about the tendency to doze off. Next slide.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll do this slide. And then we'll take our break. But this is about verbal abuse self-defense. And this is a slide that's very interesting because it puts together a lot of the aspects of verbal abuse and how communication has a tendency to do this. And so normally I would just sort of breeze over this and say it's very interesting. But when I'm teaching it as a class, I have the opportunity to walk you through every little box on this slide. So prepare to suffer. All right. Here is the verbal abuse self-defense process. The first thing you do is you detect the attack, then you characterize it, then you react appropriately, and then you follow through. It's very simple. So how do you detect attack? And the way you detect the attack, basically verbal abuse, well, there's some obvious verbal abuse, like if I just sit here and scream at you, that's pretty obvious. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is essentially a verbal deception. It's a trick that people use to try to cause you to make certain kinds of errors that have harmful effects on you and beneficial effects on them. I'll give you some example. I'll give you an example right now just to get you started. You know, everybody knows that when you leave the room before the end of the class, it's because you don't care about it. Right? Everybody knows that. So that's pretty abusive to you. It may be that you left the room because, you know, you just are about to have a heart attack. You need your medicine. Or, you know, maybe you urgently need to go to the bathroom. Or, you know, maybe you're not, you know, maybe you care lots about the class, but, you know, you just got a beeper and you looked at the beeper and it said, you know, medical emergency. You need to come down to the hospital and do an operation, right? There's all sorts of reasons people leave. But that's an attack. That's a verbal attack. And if not treated properly, then everybody else in the room is left with the impression that you don't care. But this isn't important to you. Okay, so the question then is, how do you counter those things? So there are a lot of things on this slide, and I apologize. I'm going to work through some of them. One of the sensory modes, we mentioned this before, you see, smell, hear, taste, and feel. And if you match modes, people will like you and tend to agree with you, right? If they say, you know, I really feel good about this, and you say, yeah, you know, it has the right touch for me, that's good, they'll like it. They say, I feel good about this, and you say, I can hear you there, you know, forget it. No mode, you stay neutral.
What's the difference between feel? He's saying, I hear you.
Hearing.
Right.
And feeling. Touch is different from hearing. We're talking about sensory modes. Okay, so, you know, this is seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting. Boy, that tastes great. Looks good to me. You know? That's a mismatch. They won't tend to like and agree with me. No modes is neutral. Boy, this tastes great. It sure does. I think it's great. I like it. No problem. They won't strongly, you know, feel compulsed to, you know, be like you, but they also won't be repulsed by what you said. And then if you mismatch modes, that's bad. You'll get disliking and it won't be good. Then there's what's called satyrs modes, which are these instead of sensory modes. This is satyrs modes, and they come. The ones that are marked in purple here come from a mismatch between beliefs and expressed beliefs. And so satyrs modes, you have blaming, and these they use words like all, none, and every. All you guys feel the same way about this. Every time. Right? None of these things. Those are the opening phrases to a blaming sort of statement. And if you match blaming with blaming, you'll get a fight. Okay? That's just conversational style. If you match blaming with blaming, you get a fight. So if you want to induce a fight, I'm not kidding. There are times you want to induce a fight, induce a disagreement, to cause hostilities, to, for example, get somebody's attention and cause them to pay focus on one thing instead of another. You create a fight. They tend to pay attention to the fight. So just start blaming and get other people to match the blaming, and that'll cause a fight. And you can see this on internet forums every day, right? Then placating, this is the classic, yeah, you're right, boss. Sure. Anything you say, no problem. And, you know, I have a teenage daughter who says, okay. And she has the walk, you know, the teenage daughter walk thing. And what's another one? I can't remember it right off. What is it? It's a whatever. The whatever is the classic today. You know, it's really saying, you know. But, you know, knowing not to say no, and so we say whatever. You know, in other words, yeah, I'll do it, but I don't like it. You know, I don't care what your reason is. Go away. So, you know, if you match that placating thing, you get what's called unproductive delay. In other words, nobody will get anything done, but time will tend to pass. Computing is one where there's use generalities and/or abstractions. Okay, so you know when they say, "I think that looks good," yeah, I certainly thought about that for a long time, and I think it has its excellent qualities. Oh boy, okay, so if everybody does that, you don't get anywhere. Actually, you do. You slowly get somewhere, but slow productive delay. I'm sorry, distractive, right? That's you flip from one thing to the other. And if somebody matches you, you get what's called helter-skelter. You know, if you've heard the song, helter-skelter, da-da-da-da-da-da, helter-skelter, that's what you get, right? So let's see, the typical version of this is, like, if I want to talk about something on this, all right, so to give you an example, so when you come down and you talk about feelings, so you understand what I'm saying, right? Okay, so if I do that, and you do that, where do you think the conversation is going? Helter-skelter is where it's going. And then there's something called leveling. That's where you tell the simple truth as you see it. And if you get a match between the participants, then you get something called honesty, and that's not always a good thing. So be careful about that honesty thing. It can really get you. Well, boss, the simple truth is I think it's a stupid idea, and I'm not interested in doing it. And as far as I'm concerned, it's the fifth stupid idea you've had this week, and I'm not doing any of them. Well, that'll get you far, right? Well, it's honest. I'm being honest. I'm leveling. I'm telling you the simple truth as I see it, right? Okay, so that, like I said, it's not always good, but that's... So you can create these different situational circumstances based on the other person's style and your style. Let's see, another... There's some other interesting ones... This is a presupposition plus baiting plus harsh emphasis leads to attack. And that's the, everybody knows when you do this, it means that. Okay? And so the wrong way to react, all right, so look, this is a pattern. I want to keep this relevant to what we're talking about here, about these deception patterns. This is a pattern. It's a speech pattern that in our language is very clear. Okay, it's a common pattern. It's used again and again and again. It's a bait. It's inducing you to start a fight with me. Okay, I'm not fighting. I didn't say it in a tone that was nasty, although I had some harsh emphasis. It wasn't quite a fight when I said it, but when you responded with an escalation, it became a fight, and you were perceived as starting the fight. You know, when you leave like that, you know, I just think that means, you know, you don't care about what we're doing here. And you say, I do so care about what we're doing here. It's very important to me. Now you're fighting. Okay? And so what you have to do in these, first of all, you ignore the bait. Even you could do that. Right? You ignore the what you could do and pay attention to the presupposition. In this case, it's you're incompetent. Right? Or you don't care about the company. And that's why you do this thing. Then you transmit the it won't work or I won't play message. You ignore the bait and you ask a question like this. When did you get the idea that I didn't care about the company? And now you're forcing them to identify some moment in time when they got some impression about you. There are a couple of things they can do. One of them is they say, they can sort of back down, which is fine. Another one is they can try to escalate, in which case now they're starting the fight. All right, so you get the idea. It turns out there are whole sets of techniques. They're very specific techniques. They work in social situations in this language that we have, that we use to communicate. And these are essentially deceptions that people learn and do at a low level. And if you know what's happening, you can react to them in such a way that your pattern matching doesn't lead into the fight, and instead leads towards the resolution that's most favorable to you. Next slide. Ah, see, this is, I love this. This is my stress chart. All right, this will be the last one before the break. This is a chart that has cause, emotion, and behavior. And this is one of those hokey psychobabble things, so it's only so good. It's not really that good, but I like it. It says that if somebody is being aggressive or apathetic, it means that they're having an emotion of hostility, which means they're probably frustrated about something. So when I observe aggression or apathy, I figure, hey, there's some hostility here, and I go and try and get at what the cause is. You know, what's frustrating you? You know, you seem to be upset about something. You know, let's get towards that. If you solve the frustration, you'll reduce the hostility and get rid of the aggression or the apathy. Although I guess some people just are couch potatoes and don't give a hoot anyway. But oh, gee, that was my frustration inducing hostility, which made me aggressive against the apathetic, right? You've got to be careful there. All right. Similarly, if I see fear, fear means that there's some threat or some perceived threat. And it also means that the likely behaviors are either a fight or a flight. And if I continue to increase this threat, then I'll get fight or flight. If I can act to reduce this threat, the fear will go down and I won't get the fight or flight and we'll get towards something else. So I can choose the way I want it to go. Similarly, conflict causes anxiety, which leads to inefficiency. So if you guys aren't really performing very well, I figure that, you know, maybe you're anxious about something and I try to resolve whatever the conflict is. Usually the conflict is you're not doing the work I told you to do. That's a little frustration leading to. All right, you get the idea. Violation of values leads to guilt, which leads to arbitrary rejection. You get crying, which comes as a result of sorrow, which is caused by loss. And finally, you get failure, which causes self-pity, which leads to overindulgence, which means that I have a feeling of failure because I obviously overindulge in my eating habits. I must pity myself for not getting enough food or something. I don't know.
Are you going on the basis here that emotion causes behavior?
Am I going on the basis that emotion causes behavior? That is the claim of this slide. I wouldn't rush to say that I embrace it, but I have found it useful, and it's not necessarily true that it goes this way. Maybe just if you overindulge, you start to feel self-pity, and then you feel as if you failed. I don't know. But I think it's left to right.
Behavior is another culture.
Yeah, we'll get to cultural bias later, but yeah. There are certainly cultural biases associated with these things. Most of this, the stress that things like threat causing fear resulting in flight, this has to do with the structure of your brain, I believe. So I don't think that's cultural. In fact, as far as I'm aware, these are all cross-cultural. I don't believe any of these things differ substantially from culture to culture. You will see different reflections of it. That is, the behaviors associated with inefficiency will be different in different cultures. The way people respond will appear different, but it's still a case of inefficiency. It's just, it'll happen in different forms. You know, in Britain, people will have a very different way of telling you that they're in this fear situation. They'll have a much different way of fleeing or fighting in their verbal communication. But nevertheless, the process still happens. Yeah. You very often see these in isolation, and there are often very clear causes. There are lots of cases where people have multiple problems. I mean, not everybody is so simplistic, you know, that today they're feeling threatened and therefore they're fearful. They may also be in some conflict and have just had a loss and feel as if they're a failure in their job because they're, you know, in their 40s. So, I mean, certainly you can get them in combination, but typically one will be emphasized at any given time. All right, let's now that you've gotten a chance to rest and recuperate, and I've continued conversing for the duration, let's flip to the next slide and see what comes next, because you never know. Preconceptions, okay. So preconceptions induce selective attention. Typical, you have a predisposition that creates an expectation to hear what you want to hear or see what you want to see. So if you want to hear that I'm really interested in this thing, and I'm kind of neutral on it, you'll interpret it as I'm really interested, right? That's just how it is. If you want to, if you're expecting to see, you know, an absolutely, you know, the perfection of human beauty in some person that you're meeting somewhere, that person will have to be way, way out of the norm before you'll abandon the notion that they are the model of perfection. In fact, as you fall in love, especially when you fall in love with somebody, it begins to not matter. You know, you don't see what's really there. Right? If you saw photographs, you might not think the same thing as you think when you're in their presence. And the classic example is from the movie The Music Man. Has anybody here ever seen The Music Man? Okay, so you've got to go see The Music Man, if only because it's now a course assignment. And in The Music Man, there's a scene, and I don't want to give too much of the movie away because it's a wonderful movie. There's a scene where there's this band, this boys band in this town. And the boys band is sitting there playing, and they're dressed. They don't look that good, but they play just terrible. You know, they're playing like, you can't hardly make out anything of the tune. Their parents are sitting there and saying, "That's my boy. Make music to me. Oh, they're wonderful." So it doesn't matter what they sound like. The parents see these people as just being fantastic and wonderful because they're their kids. And, you know, I have kids, and I'll tell you it's true. And one of the awesome things is my kids saw this movie with me. And afterwards, they said, "That was silly." And I said, "No, it's true. All parents see their kids in favorable light, you know, except for parents that have a very negative attitude towards children, but that's another issue. That's how you get big problems in society." But and so one of my kids said, "Wait a minute. Are you telling me that when you listened to my recital last week and you said you thought I sounded wonderful, that that's what I really sounded like?" And I said, "Not to me." All right. So you get an interaction of expectations with sensations. And I don't want you to think that this is just something that you make up in your mind. It's not. You literally hear, see, and feel what you expect to. Okay? That is, physiologically, your thought processes induce your sensors to be waiting for certain signal sequences to show up. And other sequences are literally not paid attention to. They are ignored. And you await these expected sensations. You tend to treat similar sensations as the ones that you expected. You tend to ignore or discount sensations that are contrary. And you tend to generate expected sensations on your own if there are none available. Okay, so you know, you will literally feel what you want to feel based on what you've decided you want to feel. I mean, not just thoughts feel. I mean, feel with your fingers. Smell with your nose. What you want to, as long as there isn't sufficient force against you to cause you to be unable to do that. Okay? You literally see what you want to see. You know, a wall, you know, until you walk around and touch that wall, there is no wall there. That stuff you see is a bunch of lines. That could be a picture. But you want that to be a wall, it's a wall. Until you go over and touch the thing and tap against it, you don't know actually that this is a wall. And even then, all you know is that the place that you touched it, your fingers had the sensation you thought they would have. You could be a disembodied mind. In fact, none of this could be real. All right, just kidding. Next slide. So haven't you ever, surely by now you've heard the theoretical notions. First of all, you've seen Star Trek The Next Generation with the holodeck, but you've heard the theoretical notion that you are the only thing that exists and all of this is just a nightmare in the case of this class, or you know, a dream in the case of your life, right? Life is a dream, right? And you can't prove that life is not just something that you're imagining. On the other hand, if you try to change your imagination into something that doesn't happen to fit this physics that somebody has devised, when you go try and walk through that wall, you will bump your nose. But you're only imagining it. Deceptive authentication. Okay, so here's an example of the use of this. You use conditioned response to screen content. So for example, you can individually train each user to hit a particular key sequence when encountering a particular screen sequence. For example, I could train you, so that when there's a little green dot in the upper right-hand corner and a blue dot flashes midway on the left, you hit Control Shift within a half a second. And I could get it trained to you to the level where it was basically unconscious. It was purely at the pattern matching level. And when those lights came up, you hit the keys every time. And I could train everybody else in the room to a different pattern and use that to authenticate you. OK? okay, by creating this cognitive framework wherein that even though those things happening are concealed for most people, and you don't even notice it anymore. I've induced a signal that caused you to behave differently than other people, and I use that to discriminate. So let's see, it's covert because it's almost invisible, and even if you know of it, even if you tell this guy over here that that's what you're doing, you see if they can't do that in the same timing without a bunch of training. In fact, we might be able to find mechanisms that allow us to train in a specific environment where it's hard to learn in any other environment. So that, for example, in the heat of battle, it might be very, very difficult for somebody that takes over and puts a gun to your head and says, all right, you know, what's the authentication code? And you say, well, the little red thing happens here and the green thing here, and I hit control shift, you know, and they try to do it, and they just can't do it because they just can't train that well to do that in the necessary amount of time in the battlefield, or it takes an hour to train, or 15 minutes to train, however long. Then there are many, many individual stimulus response pairs that can be induced. So this is an example of the use of these techniques for authentication. Next slide. Okay, well, we've gotten through mid-level. Now it's time to get into high-level. Now, naturally, since there's more high-level stuff in your brain, there's more to it, but we'll try to move along. The high-level deception techniques are based on what will they accept. Okay, the fundamental notion is that you know, at the low level it was physiological, at the middle level it was sort of pre-programmed or learned pattern matching. Now we're talking about logical reasoning. If you will, higher level thought, that is, they are further up on the page. When I say higher level thought, I mean they're further up on the page in that diagram that we have. So for example, this is a classic, you negotiate a sequence of contracts. And you create the expectation necessary to change their trust in you. So you start out with a little contract, a little bigger contract, a little bigger contract, a little bigger contract. And you're always reliably performing these things. You're a good contractor, on and on. You're doing a great job. You fulfill each one to increase the level of trust. And you always meet or exceed the expectations to move their expectations higher and higher. This guy's trustworthy. He can do more and more, better and better. He's great. We want him working for us. We want to put more projects in his lap. And when the trust is high enough, then you exploit it. The expectation leads to a positional advantage. Okay? Now he's in the position where he's decided he's pre-sending you $10 million at a pop once a month to fulfill this thing, and there's a two-month time lag in fulfillment. So he's just sent you $20 million, about to sell you the next $10 million, and the first shipment doesn't arrive, and he calls you up and he says, your shipment didn't arrive, we're about to send you the next $10 million. And you say, well, gee, you know, we put it on the truck yesterday. I mean, I'll call them up, but, you know, it's running towards the end of the business day right now. So, and you know, if we don't get that money, we won't be able to start the manufacturing next week. So how about if, you know, you send the money and I'll track down the shipment, we'll do it together, and we'll absolutely trace it down. Son of a gun, a week later, it's still not there. It hasn't been traced down. And then the next week, you call me up, and you can't find me on the phone. But your $10 million is gone. You get away, or better yet, not only you get away, you extort. You say, well, you know, yeah, we got your $30 million, and we really appreciate it. But, you know, I thought maybe for another $20 million, which I know you have in your budget, and I know you can slip this through, we won't tell everybody how we took you. It works. Move the expectations from trust to fear. Next slide. So this is where we're talking in the picture. We're talking about the assessment process and decisions, the sets of capabilities that you build through logical reasoning, tools that you build for the purpose, the use of reason to assess when the situation warrants the use of which tools as opposed to the trained response use of those tools. And then there's this feeds up towards that whole expectations level. So what happens here is if my assessment is that it matches my expectations, then I'm not going to change my expectations. If my assessment is that it's slightly different from my expectations but within the norm, then over time, if you do it at the right rate, I will move my expectations. And if it's way out of line with my expectations, whatever it is I've observed and assessed, then there's going to be cognitive dissonance. I'm going to say, this does not look right to me. Something's screwy here. This is a mess. And that's going to have a dramatic effect on my expectations. I might become suspicious, for example. And so at the expectations level, we have the notion of fidelity. That is, how closely do we have to match their expectations in order for them to believe it? So if I'm sending you network traffic, and it matches your expectations of network traffic, then I'm going to create a match, and you're not going to say that's any different from your expectations. You're just going to say it matches my expectations. Looks like network traffic, looks legitimate to me. That must, you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. If it looks like network traffic, it's got content like network traffic, it's got the right IP addresses, the right timing characteristics, this is network traffic. Ha-ha. So if I want to fulfill your expectations, that's what I do. If I want to move them, then I create something that looks a little bit strange to you and cause you to investigate a little bit. And you say, oh, it's a little bit different than what I thought, but yeah, it could happen. Or, oh, gee, look what they're doing. That's pretty interesting. Or I can really screw you up. I mean, I can create network traffic that will just, you know, you look at it and you say, there's no way. They're doing something really hokey here. I don't know what it is. For example, you know, if you saw the same network traffic that you sent yesterday happen again today, then you would say, wait a minute, something's screwy here. Examples that you might be familiar with. So that's the issue of fidelity. and then there's the issue of you have biases in your expectations. You're predisposed to have certain expectations and so forth. There's a level of effort issue. It takes a lot more effort to think than to do pattern matching. So most people will say, if it takes too much thinking, I just won't do it. You know, I won't do that one. So it doesn't look right. It's a little bit confusing. It's 4 o'clock. Nah, look, we're not going to investigate this. This is probably just what we thought it is. Just keep going. Don't worry about it. Okay? And then there's the consistency with observables. That's what I was talking about before, that expectations have to be reasonably consistent with observables. If they're inconsistent with observables, you get dissonance. And then somewhere, again, higher on the chart, not necessarily attributing any higher level brain function to it, probably pattern matching might be the highest level brain function we have if you're talking about quality and skill and amazing capabilities, although just the observation mechanisms are astonishing. The notion of intent, which is perhaps objectives, quality, schedule, and budget, which drive expectations. So if you have something you're trying to accomplish, you have some budget to accomplish it with, you have a schedule, you have some quality with which you have to do it, then these things will drive your expectations. Okay, and there's in negotiation, there's an old tactic that says, expect more, you get more. Okay, and that's true. The more you expect for, you expect, the more you negotiate for, the more you tend to get, within reasonable bounds. If you get to cognitive dissonance, you're going to find that negotiations break down. If you don't match modes, you're going to find that you create difficulties in the interaction. Next slide. Okay, so there are limits to your ability to reason. We've said now that we're in a situation, let me just go a little bit backwards. I'll come back to this later. But we have these different levels of this diagram. It turns out there are specific mechanisms that move things between levels. Okay, if we're below your detection threshold, then it'll never get past your sensors. So if we have a high frequency sound you can't hear, you don't have a special sensor to pick it up, you won't hear it, and it won't get past your sensors. It'll be a low level deception. It'll be concealed at the lowest level of your cognition. If you can detect it, but your pattern matching, you know, see, this is, you know, there's a light bulb, looks like a light bulb. There's a fire thing up in the ceiling, it looks like a fire thing, it's not a camera. Don't even think of it as a camera. You know, your pattern matching says not a camera, not a camera, not a camera, unless you see something that looks like a camera. So that's at that level of deception, your cognition will just ignore it. So at the pattern matching level, so if I want to kick it up to where the pattern matching level doesn't take care of it, and I want you to think about something, I want you to spend resources thinking, I need to create cognitive dissonance or something really unusual that you don't expect, that will force you to stop this automated pattern matching behavior and go into this higher level reasoning. Okay? And I do that to drive you into some situation where I can exploit your higher level reasoning. Similarly, if I exceed the limits of your ability to reason, then you'll have a few options. You can go to a group reasoning sort of mechanism. You can try to get some automation, but more than likely what will happen is you'll push it back down to pattern matching and say, I'm too busy, I don't have enough time, I can't think about this, it's too complicated, I'm just going to do something else, and you'll go back to pattern matching. So by understanding and exploiting these mechanisms, we can literally force people to move between those cognitive levels and behave in manners associated with those cognitive levels. And of course, to try to counter this means that you have to counter your very cognitive nature. All right, reasoning limits. There's the misrepresentation of incomplete data. Okay, there are a variety of ways in which we take incomplete data and end up with misrepresentations of it. For example, there's this what's called the excessive impact of confirmations. If you have a small number of confirmations, it tends to be taken as proof. And in fact, refutations tend to be ignored or explained away. So if I can get you sort of a theory of what's going on at the higher cognitive level of reasoning, and you reason through it, and you decide that this must be the mechanism, okay, then you're going to start to buy into that mechanism the same way you did at the lower level, but you're going to buy into it in a logical reasoning sort of way. And when you see a refutation, you're going to look for a fault in the experiment that caused that non-refutation to happen. Yeah, but, you know, that really wasn't the same experiment, right? So the reason it didn't work out the same way isn't because my theory was wrong. It was because, you know, I've already gotten confirmations of my theory. That must be right. It's because something in the experimental technique must have gone wrong. Okay, that's a very common thing that people do. Now, of course, the theory of science tells us that refutations are extremely strong and confirmations are worth almost nothing. Okay, but we don't think that way. And Popper is the guy that came up with this theory. And I don't remember the name of the book that Popper wrote, but it's very famous. And basically it says that if you're going to prove a for all statement about an infinite set, then a single refutation means that you're wrong, but no number of confirmations can prove it to be true. The classic example is all crows are black. How do you know that? Well, first of all, how many crows are there? Well, we'll suppose that there are an unlimited number of crows. And now I can look, and every time I see a crow, say, look, the crow's black, confirmation, confirmation, confirmation. But the statement, all crows are black, is not aided by that confirmation. No matter how many confirmations you get, you can never prove that all crows are black by looking at all the crows, because you can never look at all the crows. If you ever see a single crow that is not black, end of story. Your theory, all crows are black, is just dead flat wrong. Now and forever, it can never be resurrected. All crows are not black, no question about it. So we tend to give way, way too much credence to confirmations and ignore or explain away refutations. We typically put a because in there somewhere, right? We say, well, this was not a refutation because of an experimental error. And then it's okay. Then the experimental error was the cause of this not being a refutation, therefore it's still good, everything, I was right. There's a tendency to seek confirmations. Okay, that's the next problem is, not only do we, you know, give them excessive import, but we tend to look for them. Okay, so this is, you know, pattern matching is configured for target detection. So if we're looking for crows, we tend to look for things that are black, right? Even if we're trying to prove that all crows are black, we're looking for black crows. If there's something white flies by, our pattern matching will say, oh, it's a white thing that's flying by. It's probably not a crow. I'm looking for crows. Where's the crow? That might be the white crow that you just missed. Okay? And other targets are ignored or not detected. Non-detection is ignored. The fact that I didn't detect something that might have been there is also ignored in most of our counting schemes. A very interesting example of this is these predictions. But we'll get to another one of those predictions later. Suppose I predict that there will be a dramatic change in your love life very soon. Okay? Well, guess what? If there's no dramatic change in your love life very soon, chances are You won't notice, you won't remember that I said that. But if there is one, you'll see the confirmation. In fact, if there's any change in your love life, you will probably associate that with that dramatic change that I predicted and say, you see? In fact, we may get self-fulfilling prophecies, right? We may get a situation where, oh wait, I'm looking for a change in my love life. My wife just said, dear, could you stop by the grocery store and pick up some wine on the way home? And you say, aha, my wife wants to make love to me. And you pick up the wine, you get some flowers, and maybe some chocolates, and you go home and you're all smiles and you're all pleasant. And son of a gun, you have a great time. Well, excuse me, was that my prediction? Was I a great predictor of the future? Or did you just have a self-fulfilling prophecy? I said it, you made it happen. Or I said it, I made it happen. Market crashes are classics of the self-fulfilling prophecy. And then the other one is the hidden or absent data problems. You have non-repeatable experiments. Okay, so for example, you say, I think I have a classic example on the following slide, which I don't want to save you from, so we'll get to that one. Basically, you don't know what would have happened in the path that was not taken. Okay, and let's see, I think, did I tell you there's a statistic on deception and warfare? I think I mentioned that earlier. The statistic is that, you know, the people in warfare who have used deceptions tend to, when people in warfare have fought battles and they reported deception, that also correlated to victories. That is, more of the people that said that they won battles had engaged in deception than the people that had lost battles. Okay? All right, the problem is they're not repeatable experiments. I can't try that war again with the deception turned off, you know, and see whether that battle that we won would have been lost, or turn on deception and see whether that battle we lost would have been won. They're non-repeatable. So it's a problem of the absent data. We don't have the data on what would have happened otherwise. Next slide. Okay, reasoning limits two. You get biased evaluation of ambiguity and inconsistency. Basically, ambiguous data is interpreted in context. So there's a tendency to find things that are like what you're looking for. If you have something ambiguous, you will find a slot to put it in that's one of the slots that you were looking for. Okay, if I'm looking for black crows and white crows and a gray crow comes by, if it's gray, I'll probably, that's a black crow. Or if I'm looking for white crows, if I really want to find a reputation, I'll say, oh, look, that gray crow, it's a white crow. Done! You know, it's not quite so clear. We've just figured out about, maybe it's not a crow at all. Maybe because it wasn't black and wasn't quite black and it looked a little bit like a crow, we said it's a gray crow and now we can get out of this stupid field, you know, because we've now proven the reputation and we don't have to stand in this stupid field anymore. Unambiguous data tends to be shaded. So you tend to explain away falsifications. Experimental error, right? And say, you know, you're flipping the coin and you get heads, tails. Oh, wait, you didn't flip it the same. Let's try that one again. Heads, see? That tails didn't count because you didn't flip it the same way. Multiple endpoints problem. Ambiguous data is associated with expected outcomes. Let's see, there's a classic here. The classic is the magician's choice. The magician's choice, I say pick a number between 1 and 10. This is too obvious, but they have a trick about it. There's a card. I've given you a card, and I don't want you to tell me what the card is. It could be it's taken from this deck of cards, whatever it is. Whatever the number is, if it's greater than 6, is it greater than 6? It is. It's greater than 6. Aha. Look under that bottle over there. And you pick up that bottle over there, and it says the card is bigger than 6. Or maybe it has the exact card because there were only 2 kinds of card in the barrel. The magician's choice. If you plan it right, this was sort of too obvious, but if you plan it right, then you tell me the answer before I tell you where to find it. And I just have the 5 or 6 or however many possible answers pre-positioned throughout the room, I only reveal the one that matches the one you were looking for. Look, what was it, a one, a five, or a $10 bill? A 10. See, look under that television set, and you'll see, before this, I planted it there before this whole thing. Look in the envelope, open it up, son of a gun, it's a $10 bill. I'm a magician. I read your mind and planted the $10 bill ahead of time. Then there's confirmations and non-confirmations. People treat non-confirmations not as refutations, but, well, it wasn't a confirmation, but it wasn't a refutation. It was a non-experiment. It was one of those other things that we chose to ignore. And then you get focused and unfocused expectations. And a typical focused in time expectation is, this is another great classic. There will be three events in the near future that will reshape your life. One will have to do with your body, one with your mind, and one with your spirit. Go forth, my children. Now, what did I fail to tell you about?
Anything.
Well, I didn't tell you any specifics, but these are things that are going to change your life. But what I failed to tell you, so that's an unfocused expectation, right? All right, how about this one? You will have an accident very soon. It will do physical harm to your being. You will recover. Wow, I'm going to have an accident. Soon. But I'll recover. Oh, thank goodness. So what did I miss there? I didn't tell you what's the accident going to be. That would be obvious. But there's another thing that I was missing there. Anybody know what I was missing?
When.
Thank you, when. I said soon. So I didn't say in the next 24 hours. I said soon. So 3 days later, you trip and you hurt your toe. Oh, man, this hurts. And you remember, they said this was going to happen. That was one of his predictions. My God, he knows the future. Right? That's how it works. Because I've unfocused it. And by the way, if 6 weeks pass, and that was something important in your mind, and then you hurt your leg, you'll still think that it was me. And if you forgot about it, you don't count that as a falsification, right? If 6 months later you still haven't hurt yourself, you don't think back and say, oh, you know, that Fred guy, he must be an idiot. He was wrong. He couldn't predict the future, right? And by the way, do you tell your friends? Say, you know, I went to this guy, and he told me that I was gonna have a lot of money soon. And son of a gun, it's 3 weeks later, and I don't have a lot of money. No, you don't tell your friends that. You tell your friends, he said I was going to make a lot of money, and I did. So out of the 1,000 people in the room that I said were going to make a lot of money, the 3 that made a lot of money say he's a genius, and the other one, you know, just forgot about me. So this is biased and evaluation of ambiguity and inconsistency. Next slide. Okay, you get outcome asymmetries. There are different kinds. One's the hedonic. This is overemphasis of more striking things. So it seems more informative if it's unusual or stranger. Okay, so the unusual seems like it's more informative than the usual, but it's not. It's just as informative. Right, if I was picking a number from 1 to 10, and instead of saying 7 or 3, which is the most likely answer for any of you, you chose 1, then, my goodness, that's, oh, geez. The other one is the overemphasis of specific patterns. For example, you wake up in the middle of the night, you're drowsy, and you look over the clock, and it says 1:11. Huh? 1:11? Wow, that's weird. Fall asleep. In the morning, all right, wait, later on in the evening, you sort of wake up, oh, it's what time is it? 3:46. In the morning, you'll remember the 1:11, but you won't remember the 3:46. Okay? So you overemphasize specific patterns. Why 2K? Why not 2K? You know, it's not like there's some magic associated with the fact that this calendar has a rollover at midnight at Y2K. It's only that our computers were all based on the stupid rollover. But, all right, so there's, you know, definitional asymmetries. Like you get loose definitions or interpretations. You won't get better until you hit rock bottom. Well, gee, what's rock bottom? Well, you getting better? No, well, you're not there yet. Definitional. If a tree falls in a forest and nobody hears, does it make a sound? You've all heard that one, right? Well, the problem is people go at that, they go at solving it the wrong way. They go at it as if there's some definitive answer that has to do with sound or with the tree. It has nothing to do with the tree. It has to do with your definition of sound. If your definition of sound is that airwaves were made, then yeah, there was a sound. If your definition of sound is it's something that people hear, then no, there was no sound because there was no one there to hear it. But it has nothing to do with some deep philosophical question. It only has to do with what your definition is of sound. So forget the tree, focus on your definition of sound, and you'll have the problem solved. By the way, which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's taken you a long time. It's an obvious question. Answer the egg. There were eggs long before there were chickens. They weren't chicken eggs. Alright, oh, you're cheating. Well, which came first, the chicken egg or the chicken? Well, it depends. Is a chicken egg something that produces a chicken, or is a chicken egg something that a chicken produces? Both. No, that definition is inconsistent. If it's something that produces a chicken, then the egg came first because there was no chicken until there was an egg that produced one. If a chicken egg is something that a chicken produces, then there was no egg until there was a chicken because there couldn't be one for the same reason. It's just a matter of clear definition. So you need tight definitions in order to get valid interpretations. So if I create my definitions appropriately, you know, a very strange, tall man will come into your life. Well, what's strange? What's tall? Well, whoever comes into your life, if you've decided I'm a predictor of the future, you're going to find some guy that shows up that is taller than whatever you decided wasn't tall and is stranger than something you decided was normal, and son of a gun, I'm right. And if you're somebody like me, there's nobody that's stranger than me, so I think they're all strange. I don't know. And there's the base rate asymmetries. You only measure survivor views. Okay, there's this, I think I heard it recently on the television around here. 80% of cancer survivors thought healthy thoughts. Okay, but wait. What if 90% of the people that died from cancer also thought healthy thoughts? Then we would say thinking healthy thoughts is a bad thing for curing cancer, right? Well, the fact is, we don't get to measure the dead people from cancer and whether they thought healthy thoughts or not. Because they're not around for this measurement that we're going to make. And by the way, if you're still alive, then you've survived, so we can ask you. And if you're dead, we can't ask you anyway. So anything I come up with, I can come up with a statistic that ignores everybody that died and make it seem like there's a correlation when there may or may not be, because I don't have the base rate information. It's the same as all of our new hires are very successful. Yes, but wait, how about the people you didn't hire? Might they have been more successful? Well, we don't have a statistic on that. So how do you know whether your hiring practices were good or bad if all you know is that the people you hired did this well? Because you don't know how well the people you didn't hire would have done. Same, it relates to something we discussed in the last slide. Next slide. Motivational determinants of belief. Okay. This is yet another reasoning, right? Empirical support for what you wish to believe. Okay, so you interpret the same information in different ways based on what you want to believe. After Nixon-Kennedy debates, many of you probably weren't alive at the time of Nixon-Kennedy debates. I was young at the time, but I still saw it. It was kind of interesting. Supporters for both sides said they believed they won. That is, not just supporters, honest people who were pro-Democrat or pro-Republican who were asked who they thought won the debate, tended to say that their guy won, regardless of which side they were on. Now, history shows Kennedy won. Therefore, the historical films show that everybody knew that Kennedy won the debate and that television made the difference. And that's the way it was. By the way, that was a Walter Cronkite imitation, in case you missed it. I'm not very good at doing Walter. Mechanisms of self-serving beliefs. Typically, if you want to believe in something, looking at some set of data, you will ask whether you can still believe. And if you can, if there's any way I can still believe, then the data will support my belief. Similarly, if you're a non-believer, you ask the other question, must I believe? In other words, if there's any way I can not believe, I won't believe. So what's the evidence for God? Okay? The evidence for God is all around you. Right? So if you believe, son of a gun, that wall is evidence of God. And if you're a non-believer, that wall is exactly the evidence there is no God. One way or the other, you know, and this is a big difference. The can I versus the must I is a huge difference. And especially when you're evaluating, you know, things that aren't ones and zeros and test it against ones and zeros, there's a lot of shading that can happen in there, and your statistics can vary, you know, greatly. Then there's something called optimistic self-assessment. Did you know that 78% of all people believe that they are above average both in beauty and in mental capacity? All of you know that you're above average in mental capacity, right? Right? Who here believes they are below average in mental capacity? No, you're just kidding, see? Not one of you actually believe it. You all think you're smart. Well, it turns out I could have, you know, I could have people from the local, you know, institution for the people that can't open their mouths and ask them if they think that they're smart, and over half of them would probably say, yeah, I'm smarter than average. I'm not a genius. I'm smarter than average. Right? Lake Wobegon. You ever hear of Lake Wobegon? Right? All the children are above average. Next slide. All right.
What?
You've never heard Garrison Keillor with his Lake Wobegon. Well, you should listen to Garrison Keillor. What's the name of that show? The Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah.
Very widely listened to. I mean, it's on public radio all over the country, and it's actually one of the most popular shows, radio shows in America. And it's very funny. And has good entertainment. Another reasoning limit is the biasing effect of secondhand information. And there are two phenomena. One is called sharpening, and the other one's called leveling. And they, you know, where they get these words, I don't know. I think they're euphemisms for what they really mean. Sharpening means emphasize, and leveling means de-emphasize. So people emphasize the focal points and de-emphasize side points. The problem is that what's focal versus side depends on the interpreter, depends on the person that was there. So, you've heard the story of the blind man and the elephant, right? Who has not heard the story of the blind man and the elephant? Oh, this is great. You know, I love crowds that just don't know all this historical stuff. All right. You know, you get three blind men, and they come up to an elephant. And they're asked, what's the elephant like? And one says, it's like a brush. And the other one says, like a brush? Are you crazy? It's like a sword. And the other one says, you're both crazy. You know, it's like a damp cloth. Well, they're all right. The one that said it's like a sword is right because he felt the tusk. And the one that thought it felt like a brush was right because he felt the tail. And the third member felt the tongue. So they're all right, but it matters. It depends on your point of view. So it turns out that people tend to emphasize or sharpen the things that they find most interesting about a situation and de-emphasize, which is called leveling, the things that they consider to be less important to the situation. And the problem here, of course, is that focal versus side depends on the interpreter. So if you are at a bank robbery, for example, you'll find that many different witnesses will have very different views of what took place. And they'll all report different things as having taken place, even though they were at the same event and actually saw the same thing. The classic is that one person might say, the bank robber had tennis shoes, and somebody else might say cowboy boots. And the person that says cowboy boots might go into description of the cowboy boots, and the person who says tennis shoes might talk about how they were, you know, they were running away very quickly, and they thought they saw tennis shoes. So what you have then is that the things that the different people focus on tend to be the things that they notice. And if you have many witnesses, you'll find out that the things that that person tends to focus on are the things that they tend to have the most accurate description of, although it's not necessarily always accurate in that sense. When information is less direct, this problem gets worse. So that, for example, if you're getting information from one person to another, or from one person that has different social values or historical understanding of the world than another, then you'll tend to see exaggerated effects of this sort. So there are some other related effects of this biasing effect associated with secondhand information. And they include corruption with transitivity. There's the well-known game of telephone where even if I give you a relatively difficult to screw up phrase and you pass it from person to person, it will change on its way around the room. And this is, of course, a game that many children play when they're young, or at least did when I was young, which was quite some time ago. Another thing that happens is that in order to enhance the reader interest, people will tell a story that they think is a better story than the story would otherwise be. So they'll start out with a story of a rock that fell and crushed a hiker out in one of the national parks, for example. And the next person that tells the story will talk about how a hiker out in Yosemite got killed by a falling rock that fell from a cliff. They added that fell from a cliff thing. And then the next person might say that there was a hiker walking along one of the back trails and a rock fell from one of the cliffs and knocked him off the ledge and crushed him. And the next person might say that there was a guy that fell off a ridge and the rock simultaneously happened to fall and crush him, probably because there was an earthquake. And somebody else will be talking about how that last earthquake, you know, killed at least one extra victim, and that was the guy out in the national park who had, you know, slipped on a trail and was you know, slid down the embankment and was on the ground, and the rock fell down from a different direction and crushed him. And by the time you're done, there will probably be a squirrel involved somewhere. So, you know, you find out that squirrels are a threat to humanity. Another thing that happens is that distortion is used for informativeness. So exaggeration is sort of the classic where you take the apocryphal story of the guy that was walking down the street and tripped and fell and ended up scraping his knee and got an infection and it blew all out of proportion and he ended up dying a day and a half later or something. And I'm sure that this has happened to somebody somewhere, but I don't actually know of a case where it happened. But you'll get people that want to tell you, want to make a point, and so they'll exaggerate because they think it's more informative, that it makes the point more clear. Then you get distortion for entertainment, humor or interest. So newspapers, of course, tell stories that are, let's say, selectively accurate because they want to increase the human interest. So they select out, they sharpen the issues that are particularly interesting to them from a human interest standpoint and level the things that were sort of side to their perspective on it. Humor, of course, uses exaggeration for entertainment. So, you know, when I was young, I was poor. I was so poor that we lived in a box on the street, and we were happy when cars drove by and splashed mud on us because we had something to eat and something to drink. And then you get the other guy who responds, "You had a box?" And so forth. So you know, this is humor. It's an exaggeration that's funny and makes you laugh. There's distortion for self-interest. Advertisers certainly emphasize, in fact, they downright lie on occasion about the qualities associated with their products as opposed to other products. And this is greed. And then this can get to downright lying and frauds of all sorts when you get into that whole greed issue. And you get distortion for plausibility, the urban legends, where they may even in some cases take something that's really very strange and bizarre that happened and turn it into something that was a little bit more common, just because it's too hard for people to associate with that thing that actually happened. And we get the next slide. We have emotional effects of cognition. Affects are things like likes and dislikes and fear and happiness and so forth. And it turns out that if there's a positive affect, that's like likes or happiness, that improves sensory detection and recall, whereas dislikes and fear tend to inhibit sensory attention and recall, detection and recall. So, for example, when you're looking in a crowd, you're walking through a crowd, you're more likely to see a face that's familiar of somebody that you like than somebody that you dislike. Similarly, if you mistake one person for another and you start to look for them, you know, the mistake will tend to be somebody that you like as opposed to somebody that you dislike. And you'll tend to remember the good times that you had when you were at college and forget the bad times that you had while you were at college, especially as you get, you know, older and college gets further away. And you, I think there's a word for this when you... you forget the things that hurt, I don't remember. They say it's a, you know, it's a psychological protective mechanism to forget about the pain of your lost love and so forth. Then you have something called values, which is fairness, right and wrong, and so forth. And these impact interest. So there's a tendency for people to be more interested in things that they perceive as being good. So for me, you know, that being fair is good and so forth. There are people whose mindset is that they're bad. They follow the witchcraft and they consider themselves to be, they work for the devil and they worship the devil and so forth. And there's a wide variety of different people that, you know, they're bad to the bone, so to speak. Bad to the bone, you know. They say, if it's bad, it's good for me. I'm a bad dude, and so forth. So these people will tend to be more interested in the things that they perceive as being good, which are things that you and I might perceive as being bad. Goodness and badness is a relative notion in this sense, in the sense of the emotional effects on cognition. Needs drive cognition. For example, when you're running out of air, you would be surprised how quickly you will tend to find things that have air associated with them. You might find that air tube a lot quicker if you're running out than if you didn't really need any. Similarly with water, if you're out in the desert, your cognition will tend to identify things with water more quickly and more clearly. And this is one of the reasons that you get mirages that are more... they're more striking when you're out of water in the desert looking for water and you see a mirage than if you're just driving along in the car. If you're driving along in the car, you'll still see the water, but you won't enhance it as much. You'll see some mirage and maybe believe that it was water. Similarly, food, if you're hungry, you have a tendency to see food in random pictures. And another good classic example, of course, is clouds. You look at clouds, and if you're hungry, you'll see food in clouds or things that are associated with eating. So it's not just that you notice it at the highest level of cognition. It actually drives your focus of the sensor. So you focus in, you sort of pre-program, if you will, the lower levels of cognition, at least in our picture of levels of cognition, so that they're matching for the patterns and seeking out the things associated with food, which is what you're looking for. And as you see, I'm very, very good at finding food. Then the other thing is interest. So especially if you're in college and you have a lot of courses to take, you may notice that you do much better in the courses that you're interested in and much worse in the courses you're not interested in. I know that I perhaps was not as good in the courses I didn't like as the ones that I did like, and it certainly hurt a lot to be good in the courses that I liked less. Some aspects of this field are very substantially summarized in the RAND 1999 paper, which refers to and largely encompasses the content of MOP 113, like military operating procedures, or I'm not sure what MOP stands for, but certainly you can look it up in the references associated with the course in the papers here. And they basically have a list of things that they found clearly present in military deceptions that are intended to help the person doing the deception do a better job. And here's the things that they list. The notion that pre-existing notions are given excess weight. We've seen that in the other studies. Desensitization degrades vigilance. This is a version of this thing that we were talking about earlier of habituation. Then you get things like generalizations or exceptions based on limited data. So So if you have a little bit of data, you'll make a generalization, or if you're looking for it, you'll find an exception based on very limited data, even though it might actually not be supported by the data. Failure to fully examine the situation, which limits comprehension, so you haven't studied enough. You have limited time, and limited processing power can limit your comprehension. So if you're in a rush, all you can do is pattern match. And that's why they train people to fight in particular ways, because the only way you're going to be successful at fighting under the circumstances that things are happening very quickly is that you know how to respond in a more or less spontaneous pattern matching sort of fashion. So then failure to adequately corroborate is a common thing that allows deception to be successful. Overvaluing data based on its rarity. There's a tendency when you find something that seems to be really rare and unusual to think that it's much more important. And it might just be chance that you happen to cross this thing as opposed to something else. It may not be particularly important, but the fact that it's rare makes it seem important. Experience with the source may color data inappropriately. So, you know, I have a usually reliable source, and he told me this thing, and usually this guy's reliable, so I'm going to believe it, which, of course, leads to the tactic where you have a reliable source. You usually feed people the truth. If you're going to try and do deception, you want to try and tell them the truth as much as possible and only, trick them when it's really appropriate and find some reason that it was actually the truth or it wasn't really a trick so that they continue to believe you. Focusing on a single explanation when others are available is a very common phenomenon, and so we try to simplify our lives in this way. Failure to consider alternative courses of action. There's a saying that I like, that there are always alternatives, and I think that is certainly true in every situation I've encountered, although sometimes there seem like there may be none. For example, some people get suicidal. That comes from a failure probably to consider alternative courses of action, because I can assure you that staying alive, you will have more options later on down the line than if you kill yourself. And you may not believe that, but trust me on this one. Failure to adequately evaluate options. That's what I just said. Failure to reconsider previously discarded possibilities. So sometimes we prune the tree, the search tree, based on our current knowledge, and future knowledge comes along that would put back some part of the search space that we've already decided we're not interested in. And when we fail to reconsider those possibilities based on the new data, we may be making a big mistake. And ambivalence by the victim to the deception, you know, they just don't care. They're doing what they think is their job, you know, and we all make mistakes. Who cares? And then there's the confounding effect of inconsistent data. That is, when we get inconsistent data, another notion might be discombobulating. There's a tendency to not understand how to interpret it, and so you rely on some previous interpretation that may not be valid because you just don't have a consistent response.